Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc., write scholarship in the memo line, and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. There are certain things, perhaps I'm just really naive, there are certain things that you think Christians believe. They're so basic that you could hardly be a Christian without believing them. One of them, the Apostle Paul tells us, is the bodily resurrection, a thing that Christians must believe. He even says, if the dead are not raised, and he's dealing with a group of people who have begun to doubt whether or not the dead, that is, Christians who die in the faith, are not raised, if they not be raised bodily, Paul says, well, run that back to the cross. If the dead are not raised, then Christ is not raised. So it's pretty important that Christians believe in the bodily resurrection. It's vital, in fact. Joining us to talk about evangelical Gnosticism and the bodily resurrection, Abigail Favalli, director of the William Penn Honors Program at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon, and author of a recent column for First Things titled Evangelical Gnosticism. Abigail, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
When did you first start to notice that some of your students in your classes were, well, to put it bluntly, either ignorant of or in outright denial of the bodily resurrection?
Well, I started to be aware of it in a seminar last spring. So in the freshman year of our program, the students read through Roman philosophy and into early Christian thinkers. And my co-professor and I began to notice that the students, our Christian students, were pretty sympathetic with a Stoic view of the body and the soul. So in Stoicism, the body is really this kind of cage that traps the soul in the earthly life that is then kind of discarded at death, and the soul is freed from the body. And we were kind of surprised to see how sympathetic our students were to that view. So when we reached our discussions of Cyril of Alexandria and Athanasius on the Incarnation, we asked them pointedly about this. We asked them, you know, what is your view of the body and how it relates to the soul? What is your view of what happens after we die? And that's when we really discovered that a majority of our students, a pretty healthy majority, had no concept of the bodily resurrection, and some of them found it almost distasteful. You know, why would we have this pesky, sinful body up with us in heaven? Shouldn't we be freed from that, right? So once I picked up on it, I began to really probe into it because I was curious to see what was at the root of this unwitting heresy that was sort of creeping into my students' thinking.
So it's not just a denial of the resurrection, which in itself is alarming enough because it is, in fact, the central truth claim of the Christian faith. If the dead are not raised, then Christ is not raised, says the apostle. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But there's also an underlying set of assumptions that you discovered among your evangelical students. How would you describe those?
So they do believe in Christ's resurrection, right? So they held on to that, but it was more that our bodily resurrection, that was something that was sort of distasteful to them, and it seemed to be linked to an idea that the body is more sinful than the soul. So the body is sort of the site of sin, and I pulled up my notes here from when we discussed about it last year, and some of the things my students would say, so these are some direct quotes. We get more shame from the sins of the flesh. The soul is the purest inner part of a person that can't be corrupted. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, right? So that's sort of a familiar phrase. The flesh is what's wrong with us. They're reading, I think, Paul's language about the spirit and the flesh in a very literal way, in that the flesh means the body specifically. But I think that's not actually what Paul is saying, and a careful reading of Paul's letters show that he's really talking about the life of the flesh as an orientation of the person toward this world and its values rather than the things of God. So, but the students seem to be very much associating the body with sin, and then extrapolating from that, that when we die and go to heaven, we will be free of sin and also therefore free from the body.
So how does this connect? You mentioned a heresy. How does this connect to the ancient and now apparently still modern heresy of Gnosticism?
Yeah, well, Gnosticism is, I think, one way to call it. Another way might be Neoplatonism. This is a recurring thing that Christianity has to wrestle with. I mean, this is one of the shocking things about Christianity, particularly for the Greeks. Even in Acts, when we see Paul sort of preaching to the Greeks, you know, they walk away when they hear about the resurrection because they think that's sort of absurd. So this is something that has been continually something radical that Christianity believes about the body and how it's valued, and it's an integral part of the person, and we take it with us when we die. You know, Christ has a body in heaven, so he ascended to heaven in his resurrected body. So Christianity has a radical view of the body because of this. So this is a recurring heresy, right? So Gnosticism, I think it's always creeping up in almost every historical era in different iterations, this idea that bodily material world is not as valuable or as divine as the spiritual world. I think New Age spirituality tends to be fairly Gnostic. I think we see Gnostic rhetoric creeping into debates about abortion, transgenderism. So kind of a transgender anthropology would have what makes the real sort of heart of a person is a disembodied essence that is within the body. And it's the body that can be wrong, but not the sort of inner self that is kept somehow incorrupt from the body. So I see traces of Gnosticism there. So I think that's one of the reasons perhaps that evangelical young people are absorbing that, both from within their churches and then from the broader culture, this view of the body as somehow not really integral to the self.
Let's talk about a couple other facets of this that you discovered. When it came to, quote-unquote, sins of the flesh, you found that your students associated them with a pretty narrow set of sins or maladies. What were mm-hmm. they?
So, sexual sins, I think, primarily. And so this was something that, this is sort of one of my hypotheses about where this might be coming from within the church. And I think that might be the way that sexual sin is talked about and the way that sexual purity is talked about in evangelical cultures and in the evangelical subculture. The word purity is used almost synonymously with virginity. So purity is sort of conceived as a default, very physical bodily state that we all sort of have that then can be lost if sexual sins are committed. And I think that's a very reductive reading of the biblical vision of purity, which really concerns the whole self. And it concerns, yes, what we do with our bodies, but also how we use our minds and our wills and everything that we do. And it's a very different trajectory, right? Because with I think, the biblical vision of purity, we don't start out pure, right? We start out sinful, and then through faith in Christ, we begin to be transformed. And so purity is sort of more a holistic sense of Christ-likeness. And it's really something that's pursued over a long period of time in the life of faith, rather than just something one has and then loses through engaging in sexual sins. So I think because the evangelical vernacular has used this very sexualized language of purity, where purity really is about sexual activity or the lack thereof, then I think that might be part of the problem why the body is particularly seen as more sinful than the will or the mind or the soul of a person.
Also, you point out that the apostles' way of describing sins of the flesh does not focus exclusively on sexual sins or sins bearing upon one's sexual purity. It's far broader than that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So Paul seems quite concerned with idolatry, you know, and greed, right? So Paul is very concerned about not just what we do with our bodies, but what we love, what we worship, where our will is directed. So the hyper-focus on this one particular aspect of human sin is not biblical, I think.
The results of ancient Gnosticism, whether it is as a Christian heresy or as kind of a freestanding worldview slash religion of its own, kind of led in two different directions. One was toward an asceticism with respect to the body. So the body was neglected and ignored in essence. And the other one was toward a libertinism, where the body was considered irrelevant to one's, and sins committed in the body were considered irrelevant to one's state of faith, so to speak. So it was kind of two opposite results there. Do you see any hints of that in the thinking of your evangelical students when they reject the body as kind of intrinsically the home of sin or evil? Do you see any of those two polar opposites?
Yes, I think that's a very helpful way to frame it, because I wonder if what's happening is that the secular Gnosticism that we see in broader culture is veering toward the libertine, right? Where who you have sex with doesn't really matter. It's just your body. You can sort of do things with your body and it doesn't really matter. The sort of hookup culture might be an example of that sort of thinking. So then I wonder if the evangelical form of this Gnostic way of thinking is a reaction against that, and so it goes the other direction to more of an asceticism, where the body is something that has to be sort of denied and controlled or brought into line, or even just sort of forgotten about, because I don't see in my students sort of austere ascetical practices, for example, but I do sort of see this compartmentalization of the body, where what really matters is sort of what you believe cognitively, what you think about, what you do, and the body isn't really an integral part of one's spiritual life or praxis. So I would say they veer toward more the ascetic denial, but without the sort of austere practices. It's just kind of a neglect or a forgetting of the body. And I suspect it probably is a reaction against the libertine sort of Gnosticism that we see in secular culture, especially college-age secular culture.
We're talking about evangelical Gnosticism and the bodily resurrection. Abigail Favalli is our guest. She's director of the William Penn Honors Program at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon, and author of a recent column for First Things titled Evangelical Gnosticism. You can bring your whole family to the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Thanks to the Lutheran Church Extension Fund, child care for children ages 1 through 12 is free. You can meet and hear Hank Hanegraaff, Scott Klusendorf, Dr. Angus Manoj, Pastor Will Whedon, Craig Parton, Pastor Hans Feeney, and Pastor Jonathan Fisk. Attendance is limited to 400. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th, 15 miles east of St. Louis in Collinsville, Illinois. When we come back, how did the ancient church deal with this Gnosticism, especially regarding the incarnation of Jesus?
Till you hear from me, there ain't no grave can hold my body down. Ain't no grave can hold my body down.
Have you ever wanted to better understand philosophy and its impact on your family, your church, or your world, but didn't know where to begin? Concordia University, Wisconsin has an innovative, free online course for you entitled Philosophy Kata Christan. These six engaging video sessions are taught by noted Lutheran philosopher, lecturer, author, and pastor, Dr. Gregory Scholz. Learn more by clicking the Kata Christan logo at issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the language of medicine and law today. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to Sacred Music for the Easter Season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Well, I think one thing we're going to do right out of the gate is define what pro-life is.
Scott Klusendorf talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That term is now being confused. It's being put up for grabs, and we're going to make clear what the pro-life syllogism is, how we can make that case for life with people who don't accept biblical authority, who maybe don't even know what it is we stand for, and are subject to being confused. So there's a crying need to clarify what pro-life means, what our actual arguments are, and then we'll look at five bad ways people argue against the pro-life case in the public square so that we can be prepared to give good, solid, Christ-honoring answers.
You can meet and hear Scott Klusendorf making the case for life at the Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Learn more about conference speakers and topics and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Wednesday afternoon, we're talking about evangelical Gnosticism and the bodily resurrection. Abigail Favalli is our guest, author of a recent column for First Things titled Evangelical Gnosticism. Abigail, in your article, you go back and you actually talk about how the ancient Christian thinkers cut to the chase. They understood the implications for this kind of Gnostic view of the body on the incarnation of Jesus Christ. So how did they combat this Gnosticism regarding Christ's incarnation?
Well, they responded very strongly and rejected it. So we see that response in Cyril of Alexandria, in his debate with Nestorius over the nature of Christ. And he's responding to this desire to keep God separate from the life of the body, to keep God protected somehow from suffering, from various sort of bodily realities, whereas Cyril really doubled down on Christ having two natures in one person, fully divine and fully human. You have Athanasius responding to it in his work on the Incarnation, which I think is just personally one of the most beautiful theological texts that has ever been written. And it is a resounding defense of the body and its importance in Christian salvation. The heart of Christianity is the incarnation of Christ, which then enables our salvation. So the resurrection, the incarnation, all of this are connected, and all of these things are very bodily. So Athanasius writes very powerfully about how human nature has to be restored in its entirety, and that involves a bodily element because we are embodied beings. Augustine also responds to this idea in his time. And he responds very specifically to the misreading of Paul's language of the spirit and the flesh as conflating the flesh with the body. And he does this in City of God, and I was shocked to read it. I was reading it for the first time last year when we first encountered this problem in our students, and I was just floored because he was responding exactly to the kind of rhetoric that I hear in my evangelical students, where they assume that Paul's use of the word flesh means specifically the body, and Augustine responds to that as an overly Neoplatonic reading, and in fact, a worldly way of thinking of the body and a distinctly unchristian way of thinking of the human person. So the church fathers really resoundingly reject this misreading of the body.
Since detecting this in some of your students, have you seen any of them kind of doing the math here? We started with Paul's famous phrase, if the dead are not raised, then Christ is not raised either. He runs it back from a denial of the resurrection of the believer to Christ's resurrection. He sees the end game there and corrects it immediately. Do you see your students kind of doing the math there and saying, no, wait a minute, if I really believe that the body is irrelevant and is discarded at death, and all the better because that's irredeemable or something like that, do they see the implications for their belief, and you say they still maintain their belief in the bodily resurrection, of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. And that's what's so, we could be very optimistic about this, I think, because as soon as they are presented with a thoughtful understanding and a historically grounded understanding of these teachings, they really come alive to it, and they really embrace it, because they suddenly think, oh yeah, well, why would God take on a body and come be with us if bodies don't matter? Why would Christ ascend, to resurrect that body and then ascend to heaven, right? So I think when they are faced with the very sort of incarnational heart of Christianity, they really take to it quite quickly. So this year I taught the same course, but knowing that this heretical tendency was afoot, I started raising the conversation a little earlier, and by the time we got to Cyril and Athanasius and Augustine, they were already pretty well schooled in the idea of Christianity having a very different view of the body than the Stoics, than the Neoplatonists, than the Gnostics. And so I was very heartened to see that once they read the greats and really discover the roots and the reasons for these historical Christian teachings, for a creedal Christianity, they seem to embrace it. I think they just haven't really been presented with it in many cases.
Finally, do you think it also, kind of having this robust Christian, thoroughly scriptural view of the body, having that restored, do you think that it equips them to deal with some of the things you talked about earlier, and that is the either Neoplatonism or the Gnosticism in secular society, with these remarkable results of people saying, you know, the body doesn't matter, my gender is determined by my inner being, not by anything attached to my material being. Does it equip them to deal with that better?
I hope so. That's why I think this is so important, because I think in our cultural moment, there is a great need for a strong Christian voice on the dignity of the human person and the dignity of the human body, because that's really, I think, under question and under attack in many spheres of our society, where the human body and the human person in certain circumstances doesn't have dignity or inherent worth. And, you know, from the very beginning of Christianity, if you read this document called the Didache, which dates very early from the first days of Christianity, there's a strong witness to being against infanticide, against abortion, things that were common practice in their day, because Christianity is fundamentally the way of life, right? And for human beings, the way of life is bodily life. So that's one reason I'm writing about this and talking about it, because I think in our time, as in every time, the Christian view of the body is something that needs to be defended and proclaimed within the church and beyond it.
I guess that raises one other question. Do you think your students either, I'm trying to figure out how this happened, did they fail to pick up what they were being taught in the Christian church about the body, or do you suspect perhaps they simply weren't being taught this?
That was a question I had, and when I asked them about it directly, they said they weren't being taught it. One woman particularly, she said something striking. She's the daughter of a pastor, and she said in seminar, in sort of this exasperated way, she says, how have I not been taught this core Christian teaching in 19 years? You know, she was also just sort of flummoxed about that. So, and I had other students, when I asked them that question, they said that either their pastors didn't talk about it, or they sort of said it doesn't matter, right? Like, we don't really know what heaven will be like. We don't know what we'll be like there. Maybe we'll have a body, maybe we won't, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is just that we're there with Jesus. So I think they come perhaps from churches that, for example, don't use the creeds like the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed. So they don't have a connection to creedal Christianity in that sense. And it seems like they're not being formed about this in their churches for whatever reason.
Abigail Favalli is director of the William Penn Honors Program at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon, and author of a recent column for First Things titled Evangelical Gnosticism. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Abigail, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Terry Mattingly about media coverage of domestic violence and the Southern Baptist Convention. We'll discuss two kingdom theology and vocation with Lyman Stone. And we'll get Joy Pullman's reaction to a New York Times column about motherhood titled Job Description for the Dumbest Job Ever. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. Why is it important that Christians believe in the bodily resurrection? One, the Bible teaches it, so we believe things that the Bible teaches. Two, if the dead are not raised, then Christ is not raised. It has implications there. Christ is proclaimed as the firstborn from the dead. If he's the first, then we're the rest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
How was school today, kids?
Crazy. Hector's charioteer got hit by a stone, and his eyes fell out into the dust before him there at his feet.
Sounds like Patroclus was being hot-tempered, rude, and quarrelsome again.
He always is. Dad, what's for supper?
I don't know yet. Supper is such a problem.
If it's a problem, you can use the scientific method to figure it out.
Problem? We want supper. Hypothesis? I think Dad will make tacos.
Actually, I was thinking about spaghetti.
Tacos or spaghetti?
False dichotomy.
Is this the after-school conversation of your dreams? Registration is now open for the 2018-19 school year at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois, the only classical Lutheran school in the St. Louis area.
Hey, Dad, how did my violin practice sound?
Kiddo, it sounded epic.
Learn more at school.stpaulhamel.org. School.stpaulhamel.org.